Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
I've lost the thread again. Gehazi was Elisha's assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And he pulled a fast one. And
right, took the donation.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did he get that job?
Rehabilitate himself.
He was a very capable person, Gehazi. That's why he was Elisha's assistant. He ran the school, and Gehazi was the spiritual. I mean, Elisha was the spiritual person, and Gehazi was the administrator. And when Elisha said, "Oh no, we don't need your donation," Gehazi's eyes popped out, and he said, "What? Of course we need your donation." And for him, it was too much to turn away the donation because he, you know. I mean, just try to picture this. You know, you have the very spiritual rabbi who's davening all day and learning, and Gehazi, meanwhile, had to be the administrator and had to make sure the students had food and clothing and everything was taken care of. And here they had this very wealthy general come, and he begs Elisha, just take this. And Elisha says, "No, we're not taking a penny." And Gehazi just said, "What do you mean? We need this money desperately." Like, and so there's sometimes that there's a fine line. You know, it's a big challenge to want to help out a charity or to want to help out. Sometimes it causes people to do things that are illegal or wrong because they so much want to help them that they just, you know, they see the opportunity and they just do what they shouldn't, and that's where a person has to be for the sake of heaven all the way through. If you're working for Hashem, you know that it'll work out, and if you the only way to do it is according to the book. So Gehazi was a capable, a very intelligent person, and once he left, so tradition has it that he went in the opposite direction. He became a well-known sinner. But because he worked for the prophet, now the prophet had a worldwide reputation. All the neighboring peoples were interested in the prophet, and so he went on the book tour. He went on Oprah. He went on, you know, he told everybody about. He said, "I'll give you the inside scoop about Elisha and the miracles that he did." That's basically the story. We don't know a lot about what he did in Damascus or what he did in Aram, but because he worked with the famous prophet, so I guess he was interviewed by these other leaders and other people. There are a few traditions about Gehazi that we mentioned. One was that Elisha tried to get him back. In other words, Elisha's intent was to scold him for what he had done, but he tried to bring, some people say that's why Elisha went to Damascus, that was part of his secret agenda. The Gemara mentions a lesson from here, that it says that whenever you rebuke somebody, you should always if you rebuke with the left hand, you should bring near with the right hand, which means that there's times where you have to be strict with somebody. Whatever that means, you know, sending them away, throwing them out, whatever that means. But whatever sign you do to show that you're upset with them, you have to be willing to use an even stronger sign to show that you care about them. That was the... And apparently Elisha... Why? Because Elisha sent such a strong message that Gehazi just went too far. He said, "It's too late for me." So the only question we have, though, is if he had leprosy, would he have gotten too far? Did the ancient nations... Was it the kind of leprosy they would know about? Was it the kind of leprosy they would see? One tradition has it that Elisha actually cured him of the leprosy, and he still didn't come back. The Talmud lists him as one of the people that surprisingly went off. One of the things that caused him not to come back was he felt it was too late for him. And there is that kind of Yetzirah, which means there are people that go through a period in life where they go very far from Torah, and then they come to a time where they want to come back, and instead of coming back, they say to themselves, "I can never come back. Look at how far I've gone." You know, and So that's what happened to Gehazi. He said, look how far I've gone, and really, it's never too late for people. People can always come back. That's the Yetzer Hara. Yetzer Hara says, you're a sinner. There's no way you can come back. It's too late for you. That's not true. It's never too late. But Gehazi thought it was too late for him. Tradition has it that he went to the ten tribes had a large synagogue where they had two golden calves set up. This was the synagogue of Yeravam ben Nevat. I call it a synagogue because it was a Jewish shrine. It wasn't a at that synagogue, Gehazi used a Kabbalistic formula to teach him to get the cows to talk. That's what the Medrash says. He used one of the names of Hashem to get the cows to say, I am the Lord your God. That was because he knew that would scare them all away, right? There is a power, you know, like a prophetic power that to do supernatural things that exist. And Gehazi, being one of the disciples, might have had access to those kind of powers. And but so because he, I guess he wanted to sell his services. If Elisha didn't want him as an assistant, so he decided to be the administrator over at the at Yeravam's temple, at the golden calves. And so that was his next place. And then later on, apparently, he went to Egypt. Now, what he did in between, I don't know. But the lesson the Talmud says was that he got pushed away too far. That if he had pushed him, you know, that he needed a strong message, but maybe not that strong. Over here, he reappears briefly, which is just funny. Like, we don't know what he's doing in the middle of the story. He's like, he's being interviewed by the monarch.
Is this the last?
Last that we hear of Gehazi, yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Did he actually have leprosy, or was that a word
you used
for...
Saras. He had Saras. It's difficult to know. Saras sometimes means like a spiritual affliction, mm-hmm. and sometimes it means actual leprosy, that's the physical condition. It's
And also, this Kabbalistic power,
is that exist
today?
Some people believe it does. There's a famous person called the Maral he was in Prague, and they had a lot of trouble from anti-Semitism, and the police weren't really helping the Jewish people in those days. So the legend has it that he created a golem, which is there's a book called the Sefer HaYetzira, the Secret of Creation, which are the names that Hashem used to create man from the earth. Now, that's, we believe that all wisdom is incorporated in Torah, and if you study Torah, you would know wisdom of how to create things. The only thing that we can create, but we can't create a soul, that came from God. So he was able to create a golem, like a almost like a servant out of clay. Now, nobody really knows if it's just a legend, but even those people who feel that it never happened, it's not because they felt that he could not have done it. They just feel it never happened. And somewhere up in the attic in that synagogue, I think the tour guides take you up there.
His grave is venerated because, I mean, it's a place everybody goes to in Prague. Because mm-hmm. everybody believes the legend, and they want to see, you know, where this man is buried who did this thing.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
It's in one of the old cemeteries in Prague.
So the Vilna Gaon had a student, Rav Chaim of Volozhin, and the Vilna Gaon was known to have learned the whole Torah. So his students one day was kind of just curious, and he said, you know, did you learn that book about creating? You know, and the Vilna goes, yeah, of course, it's part of the Torah. And he said, you did. So do you know how to create something? Is that difficult? He said, oh, no sweat. You know, like, there's no. So he said, well, did you ever try? You know, it was like a discussion about it. Like, you know, there is the idea that there are, that there's powers of holiness that existed. And the interesting idea, the Rambam doesn't hold to this, by the way. The Rambam was he felt that there's no such thing as supernatural. But there is a concept that there was supernatural powers of holiness. And in order for the world to exist, there had to be supernatural powers of impurity. And in other words, it means if very holy and righteous people had the powers that regular people don't have. So then very non-righteous people and witch doctors and idolaters had to have powers of unholy things. And so there is a belief that these things existed, and we believe that at one time, and if you read in different things, the people were not, we like look at ancient things and we say, well, come on, why, how did a person believe in that, you know, or what did they, it's very possible that these idols had different powers, or they could tell the future, or they could read the person's mind, or they could heal the sick, and those powers existed. We believe that just the same way that today we no longer really have the powers of impurity, so we no longer have the powers of purity. It's like they both have gone lost. And then there are powers of wisdom. There are people that understand Hashem's will, but there's no, like, you know, hocus pocus or, you know, like really miraculous kind of. But if you read in ancient times that there are two views. One view is that it was all sleight of hand and that those people were all charlatans, and the other view is that perhaps these powers did exist because the ancients write about it, and they weren't stupid people. They weren't naive people. In other words, we look at that and we say, well, how could that person have been fooled by that? Obviously, this was some sleight of hand. And the only thing about it is the ancients were just as skeptical as we were. And they were just as unlikely to believe things that were sleight of hand as we were. So, the masses always go for, you know, can be fooled, but there were always individuals that wouldn't go for something that wasn't really true. And so some people feel that there were these powers, other people feel that there weren't these powers. We're not stuck to one set of beliefs or the other. In other words, if there are people that tell you, you know, they believe their Rebbe could walk on water or whatever, or I don't know if that's the right miracle or whatever, maybe he could, maybe they did. But we believe largely today we don't see these things. Not in purity and not in impurity. It's just that.
Mm-hmm. Why did there have to be a balance of impurity?
So there's free will. There always has to be free will, otherwise everybody would be good. So we'll go through the first part quickly, just because we had done it already, but we were in the middle, chapter 8, Kings 2. Elisha Dibra Elisha Asher Hithya Espana. Elisha spoke to the woman who he had revived her son, Lamor. Kumi Lechi At Ubeska. What happened was, before the famine, we talked about that terrible famine that had happened, and so Elisha was close with this woman who had taken care of him. If you remember, she set aside the addition. She made an addition on her house whenever he came to visit. And so he warned her that they would be going through very difficult times. And he offered that she could go and ride out the famine in a different country. So he told Kumi Luchi At Ubeisecha V'Guri Basher Teguri. He said, go wherever you want to go. Go someplace else. Ki kara Hashem l'rab, because a famine's coming here, megam ba'olaretz, for 7 years. A famine is an awful place to be. You know, the people, when they're weak, there are diseases that spread, and there's a lot of crime, and it's just an awful time what's going to come. And so he warned her. Now, we have the story of Rus, where Naomi and Elimelech left Eretz Yisrael, and they were punished for leaving Eretz Yisrael in the times of famine because they were the leaders. And so when you're in the leaders of the people, and you're expected to help the people, then you don't jump ship. But if you are just a member on the ship, you should go save your life, you know. And so this lady, the Isha Shunami, she just was important for her to save her family.
What's verse
1.
Oh, verse 1.
So he warned her, and so therefore she was able to go wherever she was able to go. Verse 2. And she got up. She listened. The prophet told her. That's what she did. So she went to the lands of the Philistines, Shabashan, which is interesting also. You never really think about living with the Philistines, you know. They were the enemies of the Jews. But apparently you could go live in their country.
It was the very next.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right, it was the closest border.
Right, and it was an open border, and you could come and go.
I imagine if you paid your taxes, they let you, you could stay there, right? Verse 3. So after the 7 years, the famine was up, and she came back. Now the problem was, she came back, and someone had taken over her property. So she came back, and she went to complain to the king to get some justice for her house and for her field. Verse 4. And here the king, this is the king of the 10 tribes, was talking to Gehazi, Nari Shelokim. It's interesting that he's described with the term Nar, the lad. Now, he had at least 3 children, so we usually think of the word Nar, lad, as meaning very young, like a teenager, or but you see here that he's called a Nar, and he certainly had, he had 3 kids. He had to be not a Nar anymore, and he was an administrator. He was probably pretty old. That word is used by Yitzchak at the Akedah. He's called a Nar, and so some people are shocked when they find out the Medrash says that he was an older person at that time. He was not. We kind of picture this little boy on all the coloring books. They have a little boy, you know, and that. But our understanding was he was an adult. So what we find is that the word nar doesn't mean an age. It's an attitude. If a person is energetic or not. If a person is energetic, they're called a nar. You know, like that means they're young, they're youthful. When somebody is acting like they, you know, they've had it, they're just like old and they can't move and they don't want to go anywhere and they don't want to do anything. They're acting like they're old, they're worn out. It's a term.
In Yiddish, isn't a nar a foolish person?
Yes, right, because it's like a youthful, like a nar up a person, like a sometimes that's used in that way too.
Naive.
Yeah, but here I don't think it means that. I think it just means he was energetic. So nar isha lokim. Actually, it could mean he was foolish. It could be he was, like we were starting to hint at, that he was giving interviews. He was trying to just tell people stories. There are people that like to talk, you know, that like to give the stories, and the we would call them a nar. Somebody that likes to shoot the just to trade stories and things. So that's what he Elamor Sapra Nali is called Elisha Us Elisha. He was telling the stories about all the miracles that Elisha had done. You never find that Elisha went around telling the stories, or that other people did. It's just Gehazi, who was trying to capitalize on his former position. Now he's telling the stories. Okay. We also believe there's no such thing as a coincidence. There's always these moments in life where you're talking about somebody who you haven't seen in years, and then they call on the phone, right? Or you just happen to think about something, and then there's this concept that Hashem does that for a reason. Hashem puts it in a person's mind right before it comes to them. So just when he was talking to Elisha about this lady, and he's talking to the king, and then outside, vihinei, behold, Yishai Shehikhi, what do you know? She's sitting out there, Tzalkas, calling for an audience with the king, al base of Al-Sada. And Hashem did this on purpose so that the king would be willing to answer her and to help her. This is the woman, the Zebanon, this is the child, Asher Hikya Elisha, that Elisha brought, made alive. 6. So the king asked about the woman, and she told him. And the king gave her an officer, and he said, give this woman everything that she's entitled to. That's called to a sasada. And not only is she entitled to have her house back, but whoever lives there has to pay rent, has to pay for whatever they took, the grain of the field, the yamaz, v'esaras faras. Verse 7. Now then, Elisha goes to Damascus, went to Damascus, which is the same Damascus that exists today. Ben Hadad, Melech Aram, Chola. And Ben Hadad, the king of Aram, was sick. And it was told to him that the man of God is in the vicinity. So the king said to Chazoil, who was his, his trusted officer, "Kach," we'll see, he's not very trustworthy, but "Kach biyadecha mincha, take in your hands a offering, v'lech likras ish elokim, and go and bring something to the man of God, v'edirashe es Hashem, me'oso lemar hechia mecholiza, and have him ask Hashem, and find out whether he would get well from his sickness." He wanted to know. Verse 9. V'yolo chazor likraso, and chazor went to see him. What's interesting was that Aram was the enemy of the Jewish people. He had waged war against the Jewish people, and yet they felt comfortable asking Elisha, what was going to happen? Or Elisha had cured a general from Aram before, the Naaman, and so they knew that they understood that sometimes Hashem was with the Jewish people, sometimes he wasn't. Verse 9, he took the gift, the kol tuv damashek, and it had the good stuff of Damascus. It fit on 40 camels. That's 40 camels is quite a load. It says that when Eliezer, the servant of Avram, came, he only had 10 camels, right? I think with stuff. What's interesting is over here he accepts the tribute that is given to him. Now when Naaman came, he didn't. We really find this in the Torah that when the Abraham defeated the kings in war and the booty from Sodom was there, he said, I'm not taking a penny. And when he went to Egypt and Pharaoh had seized his wife and he apologized for that, he gave Abraham a gift and Abraham accepted the gift. So the question is, do you accept or do you not accept? And the answer is that it depends. That, in other words, we would like life to be easy, yes or no. There are different circumstances. You have to know what the circumstances are. Sometimes you say yes, and sometimes you say no. They felt that when the Syrian general came, if they would take the money, it would be like he was being paid for his services. And it would look like, I imagine there were a lot of people that took money to heal people in those days. And Elisha didn't want to be looked at like that kind of person. You know, this is just one of these, you know, faith healers or people that if you contribute enough money, they'll heal you. He didn't want to give that image. Whereas over here, this was just the king was being polite. When you come to a person, you tip him. You know, this was for a king, 40, what's 40 camels for a king? You know, it's not a big, it was a different circumstance. There are different answers. But the reality is that you have to look at the situation. There are times when you say, there are times when people offer you things and you feel that you don't want to take. They really need it themselves. You don't feel it's necessary. And then there are other times when people get insulted if you don't take. They really want you to enjoy whatever it is. And so you have to be the judge of when it's the proper to say yes and when it's proper to say no. That's the real truth of the matter. In other words, it depends. So Yavuyama bin Ben Adad Melech Aram. Now he's very humble. They learned that that's the way you talk to the Navi. Your son Ben Hadad Melech Aram Shocheni Lech Aleim Rehechia Mecholizeh. Will he get better from the sickness? Vayomer Lav Elisha Lech Emor, and go and tell him Lo Chaya Sichya. No. There's a debate about how to read this. Most people put a verse in the English. He says, "Go say to him, you will live." But if you look in the Hebrew, it says, Lo chaya sichya, you will not live. What you have to read it is say, he asked him, you'll say to him, no, you won't die. Chaya sichya, you will surely live. Vareini Hashem ki mos yamos. But really, Hashem had showed him that he would die. Some people say that he told him, you should tell him that he will live, but he won't. Or his question was, will he die of the sickness? No, he won't die of the sickness, but Elisha saw that he would die of assassination, of something else. Or maybe he did tell him, you won't live. Verse 11, V'yamed espana v'yosim ad bosh. Now, when Elisha did this prophecy, he turned away his face from the messenger. But yes, and he cried, Yish Elokim. Now, it would be strange for him to cry about the death of the king of Aram. It would be strange. He wasn't Elisha's buddy. He was the enemy of the Jewish people. And it was just strange. V'yomar Chazol. So Chazol said, Madua Adoni Bocha, why are you crying, my master? The king will live, the king will die, whatever it is, that's not a reason to cry. V'yomar, he said, Ki yadat yesh etasib ne Yisrael. He says, because I know that you will be the king next, and I know what you will do to the Bnei Israel, and you will do a very strong and wicked things. Israel tishlach ba'esh, you will burn down the cities, b'churei and b'chariv, and you will destroy the youth, b'holeihem tartesh, and you'll destroy the children, Barsoseim Tivaka, even the pregnant women you'll wipe out. Now, you might think that Chazal was bothered by this, that he said, who, me? You would accuse him of doing it. No, Chazal knew. Chazal did that kind of stuff. That was his job. He was one of these, you know, he was a professional butcher. That was the, in the armies in those days, that's what they did. They killed people. But he said, V'yoma Chazal, ki ma'av decha kelet. He said, I'm just a dog. I don't have the power to do that. Ki yasa dabar garozeh. And so V'yoma Elisha, harein Hashem osak melech Aram. Hashem has shown me you will be the king of Aram. Verse 14, V'yelech me'es Elisha, and he left Elisha V'yavah, and he went to his master. V'yomer l'amar melech Elisha, what did Elisha tell you? V'yomer amar li chayesikya. He said, chayesikya. Now again, the words in chayesikya means you will surely live. He actually said, lo chayesikya. But it is true that he said, lo, you won't chayesikya. You will surely live. You will not surely live. But this Chazor was not a very trustworthy character, or not a very nice character anyway. Verse 16, it was in the next day, the king perhaps had a fever, and he dipped a towel in water, and he put it on the king's face. Most people learn he strangled the king. Other people learn that he caused him to catch a chill. He gave him the wrong medicine. And Chazor became king in his stead. And we'll get back to this Chazor. It's kind of choppy, meaning the chapters are really broken up different prophecies, but part of the really what's been happening was that the 10 tribes were sliding down a path away from Hashem, and all the miracles that Elisha had done were not successful in bringing the people back to serving Hashem. And so when the miracles didn't work, it became necessary to anoint the enemy of the Jewish people to conquer Eretz Israel, because more or less the message was that if you don't turn around and you don't do what you're supposed to, then the 10 tribes would be wiped out, which is what happened. Ultimately some of the 10 tribes came back, but sometimes when things were peaceful and tranquil and there were no problems, people don't turn to Hashem. But when there are all kinds of problems and difficulties, then people do turn to Hashem. So the trick is, and this is really mentioned in the Torah, is to serve Hashem when things are good, so that he doesn't have to give us those reminders to, hey, I'm here. You know, like the nature of it is that when things go wrong, then we complain to Hashem, we need help, we need this, we need that. The trick is to try to notice Hashem when things are well and good, so that he doesn't have to send us a reminder that to pray to him, to appreciate him, and to realize what we're supposed to be doing. But meanwhile, Chazal is anointed, and we get back to the 10 tribes of Israel. And in the fifth year of Israel, actually we're going to go to the two tribes, the tribe of Yehuda. Yehoshaphat Melech Yehuda Melech Yehoram ben Yehoshaphat Melech Yehuda. You thought it was confusing until now that we had different kings on different sides. Now we have two Yehorams. We have a Yehoram of the 10 tribes, and we have a Yehoram of the two tribes. Same name. It's a beautiful name. It means the Yud Hey is God's name. Yehoram, God will be uplifted. Right? But it's not clear why they both chose that name. Maybe there was something that happened that they liked that name, or maybe they wanted to unite. The two sets of tribes, they fought together in war, so they were allies. And so they both were going along the same path. What had happened was Yehoshaphat was a righteous king, and he wanted to do outreach to the northern kingdom, and therefore one of his wives was from the house of Achav. Achav had a huge family. And instead of it working that he did outreach to them, they did outreach to his kingdom. And he brought really idolatry into the two tribes, which is what sometimes happens. In other words, sometimes you reach out. You got to be careful when you do outreach. 17. Ben Shloshim Shana, he was 32 years old and he became king, and he was king for 8 years. V'yehu v'derech malchus Yisrael. And instead of acting like the kings of David, kings of David were unique, that David HaMelech had a... was the role model for a king. He was the most dedicated, the most he was the sweet singer of Israel. He was close to God. He dedicated his life to the people and justice, and he found new ways of serving Hashem and of creating the Beit HaMikdash. And the kings that were in that model, he admitted when he was made mistakes, and he went to war to save Jewish lives. But the kings who were in that model followed in his path. Over here, though, it mentions that this was a king from the house of David. He acted like the kings of Israel. What we read about the kings of Israel is that they were a bunch of assassins and politicians, and if they wanted a vineyard, they just had the person killed so they could seize the vineyard, and just terrible kings like other countries. And so instead of following the path of the righteous kings of the house of David, he followed his mother's side. He went on the path of Bederech Malchus Yisrael. Kasher, just like the house of Achav, ki bas Achav ha'isolish, because he had married into that family. V'yas hara b'nei Hashem, and he did evil in Hashem's eyes. So now it was the worst scenario. Not only was it bad enough that most of the Jewish people was serving idols and following the ways of Achav. Now even the tribe of Yehuda had gone that route. V'lo av Hashem l'hashis Yehuda, but Hashem did not give up on the house of Yehuda. L'man David, for the sake of David. Hashem wanted there to remain some leadership for the house of David throughout all the days. There's an idea that throughout history that it's the Davidic line that Jewish leadership comes from. That's part of that blessing, that there will always be some remnant of that house of David. And throughout much of our history, it was true. We had people who could actually trace themselves through the Davidic line. I think Rashi even was a descendant of the house of David, even up until that was about 800-900 years ago. Now there are people that claim to be, but there's very little proof anymore that
there's no ascertaining the people.
Well, what people do is if we know that Rashi came from David, and you could prove you're a descendant of Rashi, but it's pretty tough to go back that many generations.
So how is Mashiach
coming? Well, there is. We just don't know who he is. So I had a son that was born on Tisha B'Av, so people were saying, oh, maybe he'll be the Mashiach. The only problem, we trace to that we're Kohanim, so we trace through Levi, so I guess he's out of the running. But that's one of the signs, we feel, is that some people say that it doesn't mean that he'll actually be born on Tisha B'Av, it's more of a spiritual idea that that he will be born during the worst of times and of Tisha B'Av, and he will help rebuild the Jewish people. But other people learn it means he'll actually be born on Tisha B'Av. And so,
my son sat on a plane next to a Mormon man,
mm-hmm.
who told him, I guess because my son was dressed in a certain way, he got mm-hmm. Said that he, the Mormon, was from the tribe of, as he said, Ephraim.
Uh-huh.
And he knew that for a fact.
Oh, he said he knows that for a fact. I see. Okay. He's got the... Okay. 20. The Yama Pasha Adam. Now, in the Torah, it tells us that when we're not doing what we're supposed to, then our brother Esav is going to give us trouble. And so, in his days, the neighbor on the one side was Edom. So in his days, Edom rebelled, Mitachas Yehuda, Mimuvalei Melech, and they set up their own king. Verse 21, Yavar Yoram Sira V'Kol Rechavimo. Now, it's very interesting. So, he describes him, Yoram, the king of Yehuda, Edom was rebelling, so he got an army together to quash the rebellion. So he went the Kol Rechav with his chariots. He who come Lila, and he went. He did a night strike. Nighttime. If you're real serious, you do a night. You want to catch them by surprise. The Yakas Edom Hasovide, and he attacked. Vesoria Rechav Yonas Am Laolov, but somehow and the people they ran away. It's interesting. It almost describes him as winning the battle and losing the war. He made this attack, but he wasn't committed to sticking with it. some people feel that Americans are like that. They go and they attack in a big way, and then they back out after a few years because they don't have the staying power. That's the concern in Afghanistan.
And
they
don't have the people.
So in a certain way, that's what happened over here. He made a very good attack, but then he went back. They still rebelled. Now, Adam rebelled, and then Livna also rebelled. Livna was a Jewish city. So what does it mean they rebelled? So some people learn that these were like the Haredim or something, the religious ones, didn't like to, when the Jewish king wasn't doing what he's supposed to, he said, all right, we'll make our own shul. You know, they lived and went and they made their own, we don't really know much else about it, but they just decided why be under the corrupt leadership. When the leadership was corrupt, they rebelled also. They didn't pay the taxes.
Mm-hmm. This
Aharon
that's mentioned previously, he's the evil
Ahav
that
we talked about. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was married to Jezebel. 23. The Yasid Yoram, we had enough about him. So again, unfortunately, this was one of the first really bad kings in the house of Yehuda, and he got it from his mother, who was from the house of Ahav. And all the other parts that Yehoram had done, Halohim Ksuvim Asefi Divei Hayam El Malka Yehuda. This just means that there were other things that he did in his kingship, but this book is not going to deal with them. Yishkav Yoram Yimavosav, and Yoram died with his father's Yikav Yimavosav, Ir David, and he was buried. Yimlach Achazyahu Beno Tasov, and his son's called Achazyahu. B'shnayim Esrei Shana LeYoram Ben Achav. So we have the two kingdoms. We have the son of Yoram in the kingdom of Yehuda, and his name is Achazyahu. And then we have Yehoram still in the tribe of the ten tribes. Malach Azyahu ben Yoram Melech Yehuda. Ben Esi Mishnah, he was 22 years. Achazyahu ben Malchu. Shana Achaz Malach Yishalayim. And he was only king for 1 year. Vishem Imo, and the name of his mother was Asayahu bat Imri Melech Yisrael. So he was from the tribe of Yehuda, but he also was married to the house of Imri, which was the basically, again, at this point the house of Yehuda was imitating the ten tribes. The Yelech B'derech Beza, he went like his mother's side. He followed, instead of following the Davidic kings and being righteous, he followed his mother's side, the house of Achav, Yasara b'nei Hashem k'beis Achav. He chosen b'nei Hashem, and it's not hard to understand because he was a son-in-law. That was his tradition from his mother's side. 28. V'yelechas Yoram ben Achav l'melchama, and he was a strategic partner with Yoram, and he went with Yoram to war im Chazoel melech Aram against Chazoel. Chazoel was the guy who wrapped his king in the who strangled him when he was sick, right? The nice guy, the wicked guy, Ramos Gilad, Vyaka Royim Es Yoram. And the Aram, under this Chazoel, we said about him, he's very fierce. In a certain way, he might have been scolding Elisha, you know, why are you crying? You know, grown men don't cry, you know. And so he over here basically defeats them, and he defeats Yoram. Yashiv Yoram Elisrape. Now, Yoram as a king had hurt himself in war, and so he went to heal himself in the city of Yisrael, min hamakim asher yuka, Aramim. In war, in those especially, they didn't have antibiotics and other things. It took a long time to get better. You know, the people, so he went to a, probably like a resort city to recuperate. Behilav mesechazor melech Aram, b'chazio ben Yoram melech Yehuda, Yor liras es Yoram ben Achav. And his cousin, the king of Yehuda, they were also war buddies. They went down. He went down to see each other in Yisrael. Kicholahu. So now we have the picture. We have the king of the ten tribes, who was wicked, who basically suffered defeat at the hands of Aram and was injured and was recuperating. And then we have the king of Yehuda, who was following in the ways of the ten tribes, who went to visit him. So both kings are together. And now Hashem is the time to get a message to the Jewish people, which was that this was an experiment, the having the two kingdoms. And there is an idea that there should be more than one leader, that there should be different, when there's only one king, there's no competition and there's no balance if one king does something wrong. And when there were two kingdoms, there's a certain value to having different approaches in different ways. we believe in the ideal world we would have a Mashiach ben David and a Mashiach ben Yosef, that there would be a leader from the house of David and there would be a leader from the house of Yosef. We do best when we have both. In other words, in the ideal world, we need to have different qualities in leadership. We need different styles. We can grow from both. And a leader, it doesn't hurt for him to have somebody who can counterbalance him from time to time. That would be in the ideal world. When each one went off and they... now we had a time where the 10 tribes and the 2 tribes were in harmony, but instead of being in harmony to do good, they were in harmony to do bad. And so basically the experiment had failed, it didn't... Here, the house of Yosef had complained about Shlomo HaMelech, and they felt that Shlomo HaMelech had abused the power, and so they created their own kingdom, and things weren't better. So now, after 4 dynasties of the kingdom of Achav, Hashem's patience, so to speak, runs out. Hashem has a lot of patience. It's not like us where we lose our patience in a few seconds. Hashem has patience for generations, but eventually it runs out. And so now Hashem chose this time to use up his patience with the northern kingdom, and he's going to wipe out the dynasty of Achav, and he's going to send the new messenger to set that up as we begin chapter 9.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.